The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis with news and opinion from our team of international specialists on Guardian Weekly, May the 21st. This week, an official period of mourning in China for the thousands killed by the Sichuan earthquake. In Burma, another official period of mourning, but the Burmese government is still in denial.
They were still saying that the emergency phase of the disaster was over and they were now into the rebuilding phase, which is patently far from the truth.
Also in today's show, you'll hear from Kosovo, where the government has got some way to go before it convinces Serbs of the merits of independence. And you'll hear from Rwanda's premier beach resort. More than a week after the earthquake struck China's Sichuan province, the death toll is expected to top 50,000. Millions have been left homeless. Jonathan Watts is our correspondent in Beijing. He says that although people are still being pulled from the debris, the focus of relief efforts is now on caring for the survivors.
The emphasis now is on making sure that those who have survived remain in as good health as possible, and looking slightly longer term, that they have a place to live. Those are the two main priorities. And along with that, there is a movement now towards trying to find homes for the children who've lost their parents and some kind of long-term care for the elderly who have lost their carers.
And there's been a three-day period of national mourning, and this was really an unprecedented step by the Chinese government.
Yes, it's been quite remarkable. There hasn't been anything like this before, partly because disasters were previously hushed up. But on this occasion, that has been impossible because of new technology and because of the size of the disaster. So everybody knows what's going on. And the government is allowing everybody to share their emotions at this tragedy. It's been new for China, and in a way, some of the types of mourning almost seem Western. The whole idea of, you know, candlelit vigils and this sort of thing, and big heart T-shirts and so on, seem very globalized. But on the other side of things, it's, you know, a huge outpouring of very genuine grief. And we've seen, you know, Tiananmen Square become almost full of people who wanted to share their sadness at the same time. Every single TV station showing the same coverage. I was on an aeroplane yesterday and we were stopped from taking off until the 3 minute silence was finished. Karaoke bars have been closed. There's supposed to have been no festivities at all for these 3 days.
And what do Chinese people think of the way their rulers have handled the crisis?
On the whole, from most of the people I speak to, I would say that they've been very positive. In particular, the Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, who rushed very quickly to the scene of the disaster, has won a lot of credit for his swift action and for his attempts to show compassion, also to get tough with the army and the local government to try and get them mobilised as quickly as possible. On the other side of things, the government has been more open about what's gone on and has shared a lot more information than in the past. And I think all those things have been quite well received by the general public.
Are there questions being asked about the preparedness of the Chinese authorities for such a disaster and the structural quality of buildings such as schools?
On the latter, absolutely. I think perhaps the biggest question over the whole disaster and what could have been prevented, it has been focused on the structures of schools and whether or not they were built properly, whether there was a degree of corruption amongst the construction companies and the local governments involved in building them, because a disproportionate number of the victims were children. And a huge, huge number of schools have been completely turned into rubble. And at times, the schools have been devastated, even though some of the buildings around them have managed to stand up, which has made lots and lots of people think, you know, why is this? Why weren't schools built properly? Don't forget that in China, most families are only allowed one child, so those children are particularly precious. And the loss of so many in such a short space of time, perhaps in some cases unnecessarily, has been the main focus of anger and frustration that always follows a big disaster.
Jonathan Watts. More than 2 weeks after the deadly cyclone struck Burma, its military junta has agreed to accept aid from the country's neighbours. The deal came out of an emergency meeting of foreign ministers from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, including Burma. But there'll be no unfettered access for UN disaster experts and other aid agencies. Save the Children was one of the organisations that had representatives in Burma before the cyclone hit. Here's Save the Children's Ben Dempsey.
Save the Children's been getting aid out from the days immediately after the cyclone. We have a huge operation here anyway from before the cyclone hit. We've been here for 13 years and we have a lot of Burmese national staff. And there hasn't been any restriction on them moving around the country at all. So we've been able to get aid out from the beginning of this using our extremely experienced humanitarian staff who are from Burma itself. And so in that sense, it's still progressing in that way. Obviously, we want to have as much freedom of movement as possible. We want as much aid to come into the country as possible. But as far as, say, the children's operation is concerned, it is getting slowly better, but it has been operating from the beginning anyway. The most urgent needs are still water, clean water supplies, bottled water and water purification. For people who haven't yet been reached, it's shelter, distributing plastic sheeting and tarpaulin. Basic food. There is a huge problem. We think that several thousand children in particular who were already malnourished before the cyclone may be at risk of dying from malnutrition in the next 2 to 3 weeks because they haven't got any access to food. So we're trying to get high energy, high nutrition food to them as well. So it's still the basics that are absolutely necessary, and it's water, shelter, food and medicine for people who have injuries, and it's those core basics that we're focusing on at the moment.
Ben Dempsey from Save the Children. Well, our Southeast Asia correspondent, Ian McKinnon, is in Bangkok, and he says it's impossible to say whether the Burmese government is shifting its stance towards accepting foreign assistance.
This has been 2 weeks in the making to reach this point, and yet when the foreign ministers of ASEAN held their meeting, they described it as an emergency meeting on Monday. So it's been quite slow coming. There's still a lot of flesh to be put on the bones of what they've actually agreed and what it'll actually mean in practice.
Than Shwe, the head of the Burmese regime, has now visited the Irrawaddy Delta. That was his first visit to the disaster zone. Will the fact that he's seen the worst hit area with his own eyes make any difference?
Again, it's very difficult to tell. This regime is extremely difficult to read. Again, it took Than Shwe more than 2 weeks to actually visit or be seen to be visiting any of the survivors. Up until that point, it seemed that the regime had put its head in the sand on this one. Even in the middle of last week, they were still saying that the emergency phase of the disaster was over and they were now into the rebuilding phase, which is patently far from the truth, according to the aid agencies on the ground.
The regime has also announced 3 days of mourning for the 134,000 people believed to be dead or missing. How is that being observed?
I think definitely government buildings, they're flying their flags at half mast. But I understand that life in Rangoon itself is going on pretty much as normal. The shops are open and people are going about their business. Many of them are completely unaware of this period of mourning. That's not to say that people in Burma are unaware of what has happened. And there's been a huge outpouring of desire to assist those people in the Delta. Many, many individuals, the wealthier Burmese, have been driving out into the Delta and distributing water and food and any other types of aid from their car windows if they can manage to do that. So there definitely is a great desire among some Burmese to help if they can. They're not oblivious to what's happened.
The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is due in Burma this week. What more pressure can the UN bring to bear on Burma?
In the last few days, John Holmes, the humanitarian affairs chief, has been in Burma. He was taken to the Delta himself to see the devastation, and he met aid workers from the international aid agencies who already had people and staff in Burma. He told them what he saw was shocking and amazing. So with him and with now with Ban Ki-moon, arriving. It may, just may, allow more international staff on the ground to help in the distribution exercise. Many aid agencies have been trying to get round the problem by training local staff in the rudiments of disaster relief and logistics. But frankly, they're no substitute for the expertise that the international community has acquired through various cyclone disasters and the tsunami. And the need to get them on the ground is becoming more and more critical.
And there's also an international donors conference on Monday. What's the prospect of Burma accepting more relief as a result of that?
Well, it does seem that the plan originally was to hold this donors conference in Bangkok, but the Burmese have asked that the conference be held in Rangoon itself. They've never said that they didn't want the aid. What they don't want is the foreign aid workers that might come along with it.
Ian, many thanks. In South Africa, at least 22 people are thought to have died in a wave of violence against immigrants in the poor suburbs around Johannesburg. Xenophobic murders, rapes and other violence have spread across the city and its surrounding townships. Chris McGreal is in Johannesburg for The Guardian.
It began in Alexandra Township, which is a very crowded, quite large 500,000 people township in the heart of Johannesburg, with two people killed there at the beginning of the week before last. And that seems to have been a slow-burning fuse. And over the past weekend, it spread to not only the townships around Johannesburg, but to the heart of the city itself, with immigrants, mostly Zimbabweans, but also Malawians and Mozambicans, being hunted down in their houses, some of them killed, but the death toll is now a couple of dozen and rising. Tens of thousands, probably at least 25,000 now, driven out of their homes, threatened because they're foreigners, told they're not wanted around, many of them beaten up, and creating a refugee crisis around South Africa's largest city.
Why has there been this sudden burst of violence against immigrants?
Well, it's been bubbling under the surface for some time. This is a fairly xenophobic country anyway. There has been, over the years, attacks against people like Somalis and Mozambicans, particularly those that trade on the streets and are perceived by South Africans as a threat to their living. But what's really made a difference is the influx of Zimbabweans because of the crisis there. There's about 3 million here. And they're not only extremely well-educated and speak good English, but they're perceived by many employers as hard workers, and perhaps a little more darkly as the kind of people you can employ and sack without them having too many rights. So they've tended to be in competition for housing, for jobs. It's really put a lot of pressure on the townships around here as the Zimbabweans have moved in, and now it seems to have finally burst forth.
Post-apartheid South Africa, for many people, was supposed to symbolise tolerance and equality. So it's a big blow to South Africa's international reputation.
Yes, although I think that to some degree was the view of the elite. I mean, the practical effect is that large numbers of people 14 years after the end of apartheid who live in townships, who live in poor conditions in squatter camps, feel that actually they haven't really benefited from apartheid or the end of apartheid or haven't fully felt the fruits of the end of white rule. Many of them are in desperate need of jobs. It's very high unemployment amongst the poor. And they look around and they see the elite of the ruling African National Congress and see that as benefiting considerably. Some people have got very rich out of the transition. And I think that there's a great deal of resentment. They feel left behind. And then they look at immigrants coming and taking jobs and houses.
And how effective are the authorities likely to be now of restoring order and caring for the thousands of refugees that have been created after this wave of violence?
Many of those refugees have moved into police stations and into churches and community halls where they are being helped partly by the government, partly by private organisations, the Red Cross, churches. In terms of containing the violence, it's quite a difficult job for the police, particularly in the warren of squatter camps where you have shacks that are very closely built together. The people there leading the attacks know these areas very well, and it's very hard to pursue them. Also, a lot of these attacks happen at night when people are sleeping. It's a difficult job for the police. There have been calls from some for the army to be sent in. There are questions about what difference that would make, although perhaps a presence on the ground would discourage people. But that rings certain alarm bells, because the last time the army was in the townships was the last time that we saw this kind of violence, which was during the last years of apartheid, when there were the politically driven rivalry between the ANC and the Inkatha Freedom Party.
Chris, many thanks for talking to us. I'm John Dennis, you're listening to Guardian Weekly. Still to come this week, what Kosovo Serbs think about independence. A letter from Rwanda from one of our readers. And the EU Commissioner talks to us about the Middle East peace process.
We have to go on, accompany this peace process, get it, so to say, out of the difficult moment.
But first, one of the most important allies in the fight to protect the world's biggest tropical rainforest was Brazil's Environment Minister, Marina Silva. But last week she resigned, along with two other top environmental officials. Rory Carroll, the Guardian's South America correspondent, explains why she quit.
And she felt basically she couldn't do her job. This is a very dedicated woman who's from the region. And she felt that she was failing to deliver the goods, which is protecting the Amazon rainforest as she saw it. She said that there was so much infighting in the government, especially from governors on the frontline Amazon states who want to develop the region and who want to turn a lot of the rainforest into farmland, that they were actually emerging as more powerful figures within the government, and that she was just fed up losing battles. She was losing one internal cabinet battle after the other.
And how has her departure from the government been greeted by environmentalists?
Very, very badly. They felt that although she was kind of a lonely figure within the cabinet, that she was at least a reassuring figure because she was on their side. Her commitment to protecting the rainforest was unquestioned. So environmentalists are very, very shaken by her departure.
I mean, can Brazil's environment be protected at the same time as the government allows economic growth?
It's a huge dilemma for the country. The country does need to develop, and it has a right to develop. Brazil has turned into an agricultural superpower, and a lot of that means that they're wanting to use unexplored lands. So it's just this ongoing battle in the country, and it seems now within the government that the pro-development side have the upper hand, and that this attempt to find a happy compromise between environmental protection and development so far is now eluding the government of Lula.
Marina Silva's replacement in the government is Carlos Mink, a co-founder of Brazil's Green Party. Is he a credible figure?
Yes and no. Certainly environmentalists feel that he's on their side and that his heart is in the right place. But the question is he a big hitter, and will he be able to establish himself within the department and turn that department into a sufficiently powerful figure within the government to win at least some of the battles that Marina Silva was unable to win? Now, given that she was in that job for something like 4 years and she basically failed to do so, people are pretty sceptical that with the best will in the world that Carlos Mink just may not be able to succeed where she failed.
And how much political damage has Marina Silva's departure done to the Brazilian government?
Well, it certainly dented what were already, frankly, the shaky green credentials of the government of President Lula. He's now going to be on the defensive, at least on the environmental front, in the future. So I think, yes, it's done quite a bit of damage to that green image.
Rory, many thanks. Now, Natalie Bennett, editor of the print edition of Guardian Weekly, joins us. Natalie, great news this week. Julius Caesar, as he really was.
French archaeologists have found this amazing bust of Caesar, and he wasn't a handsome young man that you might imagine and many of his images show. In fact, he's a man with the showing the cares of office in the lines on his face. And what's more, he's a man with a comb over. He's got this big tuft of hair coming from the back of his head right over his forehead. And apparently, I'm reliably informed that the Romans like to cover their brow. So here he was being really sensitive about his receding hairline.
And it's the only bust that was created while Julius Caesar was still alive.
Exactly. They found this in Alais in southern France, one of the colonies that he founded there. And they think this is the real image of Julius Caesar. You're looking into his eyes, into his face.
Also in this week's paper, Natalie, is Yemen the worst place to be in the world if you're a woman?
I think the short answer of that in Rachel Cook's amazing piece here is yes, it is. You've got a 1 in 39 chance of dying in childbirth during your life. If you are giving birth, you've got only a 1 in 5 chance of being attended by a midwife. You can't marry unless some male, any male at all, gives permission. And what's more, you could just be arrested randomly in the street, locked up, and you might just stay there for a very long time. all in all, it paints an amazing picture of a very, very difficult social system. But it's not all bad news. What this is a story that also looks at what NGOs, both foreign and local, are trying to do to improve the situation.
Also in this week's paper, news that IQ points go up about 3 points every decade. That means that Julius Caesar, a bit of a thickie.
It would seem so, if you do the maths in that logical way. Of course, this is known as the Flynn effect. And of course, it's a little bit more complicated than this in practice. What we're looking at here is a recent study that's called What is Intelligence? The question is really, what's in your head is one thing, but the environment you live in is another. And probably what's happening is not only are we healthier, better fed, but we've also got an environment that encourages us to think in the way we think in IQ tests. So you might be very good at an IQ test, but you might not be very good at catching a rabbit if you've got to catch one for dinner.
Well, many thanks for that, Natalie. And don't forget, if you want to read those articles we've just been talking about, you can sign up to Guardian Weekly. Subscribe to it now at guardianweekly.co.uk. Get 4 free issues free if you do it now. 4 months after the government of Kosovo declared independence, very few people or vehicles use the bridge across the Ibar River in the divided town of Mitrovica in Kosovo. The bridge symbolises division. To the north, the Serbian community. To the south of the river, Albanians. As Mark Tran reports, Kosovo's new government has not convinced Kosovo's Serbs, such as radio station manager Isaac Vorgacic, of the need for independence.
Serbs in enclaves didn't accept that declaration of independence, I can say, at all. And they're pretty much sticking to the kind of life they had before. On the other hand, Pristina government didn't make any effort towards Serbs in the enclaves so that they can feel the benefits, if I may say, of independence. And, you know, there is a lack of interaction. Serbs do not accept it. Pristina doesn't show any understanding about the Serbs who don't accept it. So it is a kind of a circle. But things are a little bit more difficult than before, because I think that independence made a bigger gap between two communities, you know, bigger differences.
But as Arjeta Emre, the director of the British Council, told me, even those Serbs who want to work with the new Kosovo government do not find it easy.
Yes, you do have a lot of goodwill people, because at the end of the day, these people live alongside us, and they probably have much more in common with us here than they would have even with the Serbs in Serbia, because we have the same sort of history and everything. But at the end of the day, they still think about their own security and their families, and they never know what will happen. So one day they might have to decide to go. So it's extremely difficult.
Yet Andy McGuffey, who works for the new International Civilian Office set up to protect minorities in Kosovo, says lines of communications with Serbs remain open.
A certain portion of the plan deals with what could be called state-building provisions for Kosovo, things like a constitution, a security force, and various offices of state.
The biggest challenge, of course, is to bring the Serbs into the integration process. How is that going?
Well, I think there's a nuanced picture on the ground. Clearly, places and points of conflict garner a lot of interest in the short term. What we've found in the ICO since deploying is that we've been able to maintain a range of contacts in Kosovo Serb communities, both in the north of Kosovo and in what are called the Kosovo Serb enclaves, mainly concentrated in the south of Kosovo.
Mark Tran reporting. Benita Ferrero-Waldner is the Commissioner for External Relations for the European Commission. And she was in London recently in an attempt to push forward the Middle East peace process. She told our chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, about the current state of the process, the position of the quartet on Hamas, and having Tony Blair as an envoy.
It is not easy. Not easy for either party. But at the same time, there was a very important conference in Annapolis that has launched a peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And even if there are great difficulties, and there are great difficulties on every field, we have to go on, accompany this peace process, get it, so to say, out of the difficult moment to have it go on. And I think there are quite a number of stations and quite a number of elements that will be discussed in order to help both parties to push ahead for a two-state solution.
And I suppose the key thing about Annapolis, and indeed the key thing about George Bush, is that he is, I think I'm right in saying, the first president of the United States who has committed the United States to a two-state solution. And obviously the key point about Annapolis was it did actually set a date to try and get a deal by. But isn't that all utterly meaningless when you have this problem of who is leading the Palestinian people, and do we really have an American president engaged?
Well, I think President Bush not only has made his statement, but I think he has made it very clear he is very determined, and he will go back to Israel and the Palestinian territories now in May. And I think this, again, will give a push to the difficult moment that is there, because, indeed, the negotiations have at least officially not yet produced anything. On the other hand, we don't see great movements on the ground, and this is what everybody expected in order to make the people on both sides feel that there is a peace process. And I think this has to be done, and we have to get the economy going. Indeed, freedom of movement and access, we always have said it, is crucial. And therefore, the conference on investment in Bethlehem that Tony Blair particularly put together, together with Prime Minister Salam Fayyad of the Palestinians, is really so important. And I will also be at the closure session of this announcing conference here in London, where we want to get the maximum attraction to that.
And you can hear a longer version of Nick Watt's interview with Benita Ferrero-Waldner at guardianweekly.co.uk. Each week, one of our listeners, or readers of the print edition of Guardian Weekly, gives us a snapshot of life from where they are in the world. This week, it's Pete Brown's letter from Gisenye in western Rwanda.
Gisenye is famed for its sand, a thin slice of land on the shores of Lake Kivu, which stretches down the west of Rwanda, bordering Burundi and the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's dominated by the imposing mass of Nyiragongo, a now flat-topped volcano which blew its lid in 2002, devastating much of nearby Goma, a couple of miles away across the border into the DRC. Nyiragongo is still alive, and once the light of day has faded, an eerie perpetual flame of erupting magma is visible, leaking into the sky with accompanying fumes, its red glow reconstructing the peak of the volcano like a spectre from the past. The air is full of dust, both from the volcano and the rough rutted tracks spanning the higher parts of Gisenye. It's a town of two tiers, an upper level, with bustling streets and a central bus station, filled with kids wandering round clutching office telephones. They've somehow reconfigured desktop phones to work as mobiles, and use them to offer roaming calls from the middle of the street. There's stiff competition, as passers-by and bus passengers are approached to select their favourite handset, often fielding calls through the window of parked buses as they wait to fill up and depart. The lower tier of Gisenye, the beachfront, is another world. The space between the volcanic soils and the lake serves to identify Gisenye as Rwanda's premier beach resort. It's a place where affluent Rwandans come to take a break from the stresses of everyday life. The tiny slice of sand is bordered by an equally generous area of manicured parkland and landscaped garden, fenced in by pristine green railings, which weave their way along the shorefront to the pinnacle of Rwandan decadence, the Kivu Sun Hotel, with its own guarded portion of sand and prices to make an Englishman weep. The Kivu Sun has a checkered past, once serving as headquarters for the interim government presiding over the genocide, strategically located to enable a swift escape across the border when the time arose. It's still the domain of the wealthy elite, but today rich Rwandans and international workers make up most of the clientele, a far cry from the sites of the refugee camps on the outskirts of Gisenye, a collection of huge white plastic structures hastily erected by the side of the road, temporary dwellings for those who have crossed the border in the wake of Laurent Nkunda's march into the DRC. Gisenye is a destination of extremes. Rwanda is known as the land of a thousand hills, but in this area of sloping geography, the social scale has flipped. In Gisenye, it's better at the bottom.
Pete Brown's letter from Rwanda. Ian Chambers produced this week's programme. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.